Welcome back to our Day 2 preview from the 2018 U.S. Open. I'm Brian Clark alongside Ravi Uba, and a special welcome to tennis fans around the world who are listening in on Courtside. It's the official podcast of the U.S. Open, and after a stellar first day here in Flushing Meadows, we should have a fantastic second day. And Ravi, it all begins with another player who broke their Grand Slam duck earlier this year. That's Caroline Wozniacki. She takes the court to begin the day at Arthur Ashe Stadium as the second seed against a former champion here in Samantha Stosur.
Yeah, both these players have question marks going in. If you look at Stosur overall, her form, I mean, she hasn't won a lot of matches this season. So just based on the form book, you would think that Wozniacki, who's made a couple of finals in New York and loves playing in New York, has a place in New York, would be the heavy, heavy favorite. But last match that she played, Wozniacki, I called that one in Cincinnati, had to retire with a knee issue. And besides that knee issue, she was strapped up everywhere. I mean, shoulder, other parts of her body. So how is she going to be feeling? She said coming in, she feels actually very good.
Let's hear from the former U.S. Open finalist and the number two seed this year, Caroline Wozniacki.
It feels good to be back. Quite a few changes now since last year, this court. It's pretty cool. It's the first time I see it, so it's fun to be back. I enjoy it here. I love New York, so it's great.
Wozniacki will be playing in Arthur Ashe Stadium, but the new court, of course, Louis Armstrong Stadium. Interesting match on the women's side to get going out there. The 10th seed, Yelena Ostapenko, against a veteran who's had a pretty nice summer in Andreea Petkovic, one of the more popular players, and she always plays well on these hard courts.
She does play well on hard courts, and don't forget the start of the campaign. At the Australian Open, she beat Petra Kvitova in that marathon match at the Australian Open. We're talking about a player who was, I think, inside the top 15 for quite a bit of time. It shows her pedigree. She's been to a Grand Slam semifinal in the past at the French Open. This is a time where she's trying to rebuild her ranking, really work on her game. She's come out, I think, really committed to her tennis. There was a time where she was uncertain whether she wanted to keep on playing tennis. Now she gets this opportunity on a big stage to take on Yelena Ostapenko. And Ostapenko, we know of her pedigree, winning the French Open last year. I love watching Ostapenko play. I mean, she's such a shot maker, especially that curled forehand zipped cross court. The amount of pace she can generate on her strokes is just phenomenal. I also love her fearless attitude, her approach out there on the court. She can mix in the unforced errors with those winners. And also, she's playing a year after she won the French, so, you know, the expectations are a bit higher, and that's always a bit more of an adjustment for her. But I love the fact that she went deep again in a slam, Wimbledon, making the semifinals. And if I'm talking about Tsitsipas and, you know, his future, I think there's also a lot more to come for Ostapenko.
Still just a very young player. A lot of interesting women's matches. Petra Kvitova takes on Yanina Wickmeyer. Kvitova, the fifth seed. Coco Vandeweghe, who's defending semifinal points here, but is not at 100% physically. She's got Kirsten Flipkens of Belgium. Those are all throughout the day. Angelique Kerber gets things going in Armstrong. Madison Keys, the runner-up here a year ago. She plays in Arthur Ashe Stadium. Sloane Stephens, the defending champion. She began her title defense in Louis Armstrong Stadium to get things going there today.
And, Brian, you mentioned one there between Kvitova and Wickmeyer. Now, Kvitova on the tour, if we're taking out the Grand Slams, has been one of the hottest players on the circuit. I mean, she's won five titles, but she's openly talked about the fact that when it comes to the Grand Slams this year, there's a bit of a blockage. And she actually joked at Wimbledon that maybe she's not going to play Grand Slams for a couple of years, or just focus at tour level. That's how bad it has been for her. She's been upset at all the Grand Slams, hasn't got deep in all the Grand Slams when her form going into them has suggested otherwise. And she's taking on Wickmeyer, who has, remember, made the semifinals here in the past.
So we'll take a look at the men. But just before that, I just want to acknowledge the fact that it is 2018, and on the schedule for Louis Armstrong Stadium on Tuesday night, you've got a match between Maria Sharapova and Patty Schnieder back in the mix in the main draw at the U.S. Open.
Phenomenal what she's been able to do. I think she's the oldest player at 39, as you say, to ever qualify for a Grand Slam. So what a remarkable achievement. I believe she made the quarterfinals way back in 1998. 20 years ago doing that. And she's always been known as an athletic player. When she played the game, just such a super athlete, very graceful in her movement, mixes up the pace here and there, does different things with the ball. Just getting to this stage and qualifying for the main draw, obviously such a big thing. And given the fact that Sharapova has not played a lot of tennis of late, and given the fact I don't think Sharapova's confidence is going to be where we've seen it in years past, it wouldn't be the strangest thing, put it that way, to see Schneider win this match.
So that's the women's side, a very busy day ahead here at the U.S. Open. Let's look at the men, and somebody a lot of people are picking to win this tournament, and with good reason after his win at Wimbledon and completing the career, I guess he called it the Master Slam in Cincinnati. That's Novak Djokovic, his first round match in the afternoon in Arthur Ashe Stadium. Djokovic here is the sixth seed.
Yeah, Djokovic in the past, don't forget too, he has struggled in playing in the heat. And there was a match that he played here several years ago against Viktor Troicki. He looked like he was down and out, and Troicki couldn't take advantage. And Djokovic, I believe that he would go on to either make the final or win it. So I'm going to be interested, first of all, to see how he's going to fare in the heat. Over the years, he's gotten a lot better in that respect. He's made little changes that has helped him cope in these conditions. And he's taking on a former really top junior in Marton Fucsovics from Hungary, who's having his best season on the circuit. I mean, it's been a breakthrough season for him, for Fucsovics. So he's having a fine career. Will he have the tools, the capability to test Djokovic? Don't think so. I mean, you're talking about favorites coming in. I actually picked Djokovic to win. I think it's going to be Djokovic in Nadal final. I think he'll get off to a good start. I think he'll handle the conditions and Fucsovics tomorrow.
And one player who could potentially spoil that is a player we, again, wait for at a major, and that is Alexander Sasha Zverev, the fourth seed from Germany. He takes on Canada's Peter Polansky in the third match of the day on Louis Armstrong. Is this, finally, the major breakthrough for Zverev?
Well, before we talk about Zverev, we have to talk a second about Peter Polansky, another Canadian player. Made history this year, getting into all four Grand Slams as a lucky loser. I mean, he put a tweet out on social media, short and sweet. Check it out on his Twitter handle. But, you know, also taking advantage of the fact that new rules coming into play at the Grand Slams, you know, if a player pulls out first round, they still get half the prize money. So that's why he's had more opportunities to get into the main draw of a Grand Slam. He's taken advantage. Can he actually win a match in a Grand Slam? He's only done that once in his career. So I think it's a nice start for Zverev. The link up with Lendl is interesting because Lendl really helped Andy Murray. 2012, they came together, start of the year. By the time that year ended, he'd won the U.S. Open. And then the next year, you know, he wins Wimbledon. He won the Olympic gold 2012. And when he won Wimbledon, later on, when he won for a second time, who else was in his corner? It was Lendl again. So he's proven that he can do it as a coach. He adds belief to players. He worked on Murray's forehand. And I think game-wise, the forehand is the part of Zverev's game, which is the weakness at the moment. I think he can take it a little bit earlier. I think players know to go to that side when things get tough. And he's still relatively unproven at the Grand Slams. He did make his first Grand Slam quarterfinal, finally, at the French Open. But yet to build up that kind of aura at Grand Slams, but I don't think Polansky is going to be able to exploit that tomorrow.
Sasha Zverev spoke heading into this U.S. Open. Let's take a listen.
But yeah, I mean, the training sessions are tough. The training sessions have always been tough when I work. I'm a pretty hardworking guy, so I know what it takes. I'm not somebody who sits on my ass when I'm alone. I'm just, you know, I'm always constantly trying to figure out ways to get better. So that hasn't changed that much. The training sessions are still tough. The training sessions are tough when I'm by myself. But yeah, hopefully, as I said, hopefully it will show in the results as well.
So that's Sasha Zverev speaking about the new coaching link-up he has with Yvonne Lendl, who has had plenty of success here. Somebody else who's had plenty of success here we will see tomorrow night in Arthur Ashe Stadium, and that is Roger Federer. Can you believe it's been 10 years since Roger Federer's won the U.S. Open?
He beat Murray in that final. And since that time, you know, if we talk about some heartbreak for Rafael Nadal, for example, at the Australian Open through the years, for Roger, there has been some heartbreak at the U.S. Open. Go back to the 2009 final, the only time he's ever lost a Grand Slam final for being up 2-1. Then, back-to-back semifinals, match point he has against Novak Djokovic. Djokovic comes out and saves him. Last couple of years, it's been a different Roger, because last year hampered by the back problem after he lost to Zverev in Canada, and he couldn't really move properly. And the year before, he missed it altogether. He says he's feeling really good this time around, but he's coming in to the U.S. Open off the back of, I think, a pretty worrying performance in that final against Novak Djokovic in Cincinnati, a match where he was very poor on his second serve returns, a match where he wasn't moving smoothly. But, you know, he has a chance to work himself into the tournament and into possibly the quarterfinal match that we all want to see with Djokovic.
That is all coming up tonight. By the time everybody listens to this, it'll be tonight. Roger Federer, of course, always a favorite. It'll be packed for him. Let's hear what he had to say about coming back to the U.S. Open.
Well, I mean, it would mean the world to me. It would mean a lot to me, of course. It's even a bigger of a priority this year, you know, the US Open than it has been last year. I'm really excited and happy to be back here healthy again and feeling good and, you know, take it one match at a time and see what happens.
We will see what happens on night two of the US Open when Roger Federer begins his campaign in Arthur Ashe Stadium. So, essentially, as we wrap up day one and look towards day two, there's a whole lot to be excited about. We had a fantastic day one, Ravi, and I think it's safe to say day two looks to be just as exciting.
Yeah, and I'm really interested to see how Roger comes out. He's going to be the night session. He loves playing in the night session. Fans love seeing him. He's taking on an exciting Japanese player in Yoshi Nishioka, who was on the rise before a very serious knee injury, so he's working his way back from that. And I also like watching the Japanese players. And you think of players like Nishikori also, who like to take the ball very early. They're flashy shot makers. Nishioka is in that vein. I think we're going to have an exciting match. I would expect Roger to go through in straight sets in pretty swift fashion. But we're going to keep an eye on how he's moving, how he's serving, and just his overall game after that defeat to Djokovic in Cincinnati.
One guarantee, though, the number one seed will not lose on Tuesday. That's because there's no number one seed playing. There was one number one seed to lose on day one. That's Simona Halep. Rafael Nadal threw after David Ferrer had to retire. We had it all on day one. We're looking forward to day two at the U.S. Open. For Ravi Uba, I'm Brian Clark. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And join us for complete live coverage every day on U.S. Open Radio, presented by American Express. You can find us on usopen.org or the U.S. Open app.
This year on the U.S. Open podcast, we're doing featured interviews with some of the personalities that help make up the tournament. I'm Nick McCarville, and on our first episode, we're talking to Jason Kubler. 8 years ago, he made his Grand Slam debut as a junior at the Australian Open, and at age 25, just on Monday, he got his first ever main draw win, beating Roberto Bautista Agut, the number 19 seed in straight sets. First off, Jason, that had to feel pretty dang good to finally get a Grand Slam win under your belt. Congratulations.
Thank you. Unreal. Because, you know, but when I saw the draw came out, I saw obviously I play the number 19 seed, so I was a bit like, you know, another tough draw, you know, hopefully I can do well, but not really expecting too much. And then, you know, fast forward to now, it's sort of tough to believe I just did that, you know. Like, luckily a lot of things went my way where, you know, had a good start to the first and the third set. Second set was a bit shaky, but, you know, got on top of the end. But, yeah, it's just from where I've come from, it's just crazy that I'm in this situation now.
You can hear that Jason's Australian, but what you don't know if you're listening is that you've been through a lot in your career. There were years where you couldn't play on hard court because of how bad your knees were. You were playing almost exclusively on clay. But as recent as the spring of 2016, you had one more knee surgery, and it seems as though you're almost completely healthy. Talk us through where your knees are, because you just obviously won a Grand Slam match on hard court, and you've been playing a lot on hard grass and other surfaces this season.
Yeah, it's actually been funny. After that last surgery, I did a little stint on clay just because that's what I thought I was going to do. But then, you know, financially it was getting a bit tough, so I went back home, started doing a bit of coaching, and then a lot of that was on hard court. So it was kind of like, look, maybe it's not good for my knee, but I've got to do it just because I got to make some money. And then it just turned out there were some Australian tournaments on hard court, sort of driving distance from where I live. So I was like, look, I'll play them. And then it's all been going well. Like, I played pretty much majority of this year on hard court. I think I've only played a handful of tournaments on different surfaces. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of weird thinking, you know, when I was younger, a lot of people were saying that, you know, we don't think you'll be able to play on hard court. And then, like you said, playing a lot on clay to, you know, mostly just playing on hard court this year, and then it being quite successful as well. So, very happy. Fingers crossed nothing happens again, but we'll just see.
Yeah, how are your knees in general? I mean, do they feel okay out on the hard court?
No, good. I get little pains, but it's just sort of normal before matches. As long as I do my knee exercises, I have a muscle stimulator that sort of warms up in the morning. So if I do that, then normally it's all right. It's just sort of, normally after long matches it gets a little bit sore, but after that one it's good, and then hopefully it stays good and stays healthy.
There's lots of noise around us. You can hear the U.S. Open coming to life around us as we chat. But for you, there were a few years where you couldn't play in Australia because of the hard courts down there at home. How tough was that stretch? And then even, I mean, not even making this trip to North America to try to play these tournaments either. That was, you were very limited as far as your schedule went to play which events.
Yeah, no, it really sucked. I had to sort of tell myself, like the first couple of years I did it, it was, my ranking was only maybe like 500 or 400. So I said, look, I wouldn't have got straight into qualifying anyway. So it's not too much of a big deal. But then when I started to get my ranking up and I was more, you know, 250-ish, 200, and I was playing these tournaments, I was like, man, this really sucks. Like, especially the difference from Australian Open to I think at the time they were 10,000. So in terms of prize money as well, I think if you win the tournament, maybe you make $900. So it's like, that definitely sucked at the end, but I don't know. It's tough now to say, because like maybe I had to go all through that stuff to sort of appreciate what I have now. Like, I definitely have a different outlook on how tennis is. You know, if I was probably doing this back then, I'd just sort of take it for granted. But now it's sort of like very, very grateful to be in a position where, one, I'm making money, but two, I'm actually playing tennis, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So getting into the second round of the US Open, you earned a wild card through the Australian system to be here, but for you as a former junior world number one, you were kind of saying you felt like the road has been long, or maybe you had to go through all of that. Is that easy to say now, or how do you sort of reflect on all the challenges that you've faced in your career?
I don't know if I've really had too much time, or I've given myself too much time to reflect on it. Just because this year it's been sort of non-stop. I think this week will probably be my fourth month on the road. So, you know, there's always tournament after tournament after tournament. And even this year, like, you know, I sort of did well at the end of last year. I mean, that sort of springboarded me to the Aussie Open wildcard. So then, you know, I sort of like to give myself time to reflect on that. But then, you know, I'm playing again, and then all of a sudden, you know, come June, I'm qualifying for Wimbledon. So again, you'd like to reflect on that. But then the week after that, I was playing a challenger in Canada. So it's kind of tough to give yourself time to reflect on those type of things. But I think when this season ends, I think, you know, I'll have a week and a half off, and then really sort of come to grips with how this year is. Because if you compare it to any other year I've had, it's night and day. It's not even close to any of the other years, especially with the surfaces I've played on, especially with no injuries as well. Normally, you know, I'm playing 6 months and then something happens. But here I've basically done a full schedule on hard court, and then, you know, I've been good.
Yeah, if we look at the rankings, because of that surgery you had in the spring of 16, you dropped out of the rankings spring of 17, started this year at 341. This week you make your debut inside the top 100 at world number 98. Has it just been the ability to play a full schedule this year that you felt like has helped you climb into the top 100?
Yeah, I think so, because I think my highest ranking before this was maybe 130 or 140, around there. And then that year I did a full schedule as well. It was obviously a lot just on clay. I think maybe I played one grass court tournament, but just all clay. And then I think, yeah, just going tournament after tournament after tournament, giving myself a chance every week is really paying off.
I know it just happened a few minutes ago, but can you try to put into context that win today and beating a top 20 player and having finally, years later, that first Grand Slam win?
I can try. I'm not sure. It's just, I really don't know. I went out there today sort of not expecting much, just because he is a great player. Like, he's been at least top 30 for a long time now, winning tour events as well. So I didn't give myself a lot of pressure. You know, at Wimbledon, I gave myself, you know, there was a bit of pressure, just because, you know, I thought I was playing well in qualifying, and then I thought I could maybe give it a go. So then today sort of just came out sort of relaxed. And then sort of things just kept going my way. I didn't want to get too worked up, because, you know, even after winning the first two sets, you still can't win. You know, you got to win that third set. So I was trying to just stay relaxed. But yeah, dude, as soon as I got the break in the third, then I started getting some butterflies going, all right, let's go point by point. Luckily, you know, I had all the Tennis Australia coaches with me. But then at the end, maybe just in the third set, Leighton Hewitt came. So it was nice sort of being up one end with the coaches and going to the other end with Leighton. So that was cool. And then I got broken serving for a 5-3. But that actually happened to me, I think, 2 weeks ago in the final of the Challenger I played. So, you know, it's probably not a good position to be 5-3 serving and losing your serve. But at least it happened before, so I didn't get too emotional about it. And then, yeah, broke him straight back, so unreal. Hopefully it keeps happening, would be nice, but we'll see, we'll see.
We're about to close up here with Jason Kubler, but Jason, one of the reasons I want to talk to you is we see players reach the height of the juniors and then not necessarily be able to translate that success. Not that you haven't had success on the Pro Tour up until now, but it's been 8 years, or 9 years even, and for you, you're 25 now, but you've really stuck with it. I mean, what is it inside of you that has made you stick with tennis and continue to push you to try to be a top 100 player?
If you would have asked me that question when I was maybe 18, 19, it would have just been like, it's what I do, you know? It's not like as in like tennis is my life, but it's just more, it's what I was good at, it's what I've been successful at, so I just do it, you know? And then even the next couple of years, even with a couple of the injuries, it was still kind of just like, look, this is really the only thing I do, so I sort of have to do it. And then with the last surgery, and then almost not coming back, it's kind of like now when I am playing, it's more, it's what I enjoy doing. Some of the happiest times I have is when I'm back home on the tennis court here with my brother or my sister. So I think no matter what I do, no matter how my knees are, I'm always going to enjoy playing tennis. If that means, you know, going to a local club and playing on synthetic grass and just playing tennis there, then I'm going to enjoy that. If that means coming here and winning a first round match, then, like, that's the main thing. That's why I keep playing now, because I'm so happy that I get to play tennis basically every day. So a little bit of pain, I wish that would go away, but, you know, it's just after everything that happened, it's just I'm so grateful that I'm even at this stage, you know, at a Grand Slam, my third Grand Slam main draw for the year, so it's incredible.
Well, keep that pain at bay and enjoy. I know that you're saying you're happy to play at a club level too. Enjoy winning a U.S. Open match for a little bit too. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Celebrating 50 years of the U.S. Open with the groundbreaking Billie Jean King.
With half a century passing since that first Open of 68, and you had, of course, won the Nationals the year before, all amateur event at that time at Forest Hills. Now you come back in 68, trying to win the title again, and you lost in the finals to Virginia Wade. What's your recollection of that match and that inaugural U.S. Open?
My recollection is that I was up late with the three sets. I think I had three sets against Maria Bueno. It might have even rained a little. I had to go on and off. I can't remember exactly, but it was a long, long match. And the next day, Virginia just played too well. I mean, it's like no excuses, right, when you lose. If you win, you can have all the excuses you want. But no, Virginia won. But I was so thrilled for Arthur because he won, Arthur Ashe.
Yes.
Beating Auker in five sets.
Yep.
And his dad was there. And, oh, my God, I just loved it. I thought it was so perfect for Arthur to win, and it was great for Virginia because I won Wimbledon in her home country, and then she won the U.S. Open in my home country. So I'm sure she would have. She was thrilled that she won the U.S. Open.
Well, you know, we interviewed her.
It's a thrill to win. It's a thrill.
We spoke to her earlier in the year, and she seems to feel about it sort of the way you did. She felt like she was in the zone that day.
No, she really played too well. I think it was like 2-3, or it was really quick.
Yeah, 4-2.
All I know is I kind of blinked, and I was at the net shaking hands with her. Like, what happened?
Yeah. Well, I guess those are not as tough to absorb as losing close, hard-fought finals, because you just
the close ones are the ones that never get really bother you a lot.
So, Billie Jean, it wasn't that far into the Open era when you really started dominating. You had some of your most dominant years and some of your best opens, because you won in that period from 71 through 74, those four opens, you won three of them. And it seemed that the grass at Forest Hills, well, maybe, I don't know how you felt about the grass there versus Wimbledon, but it certainly suited your attacking game, and you're a great serve and volleyer, and you really took advantage of the conditions to the hilt. Would you say that, looking back on 71 and 72, that when, of course, you became the first woman to earn $100,000 or more in 71, that period, was that in your mind, your peak tennis, and it was reflected at the Open?
I think probably 71, 72 are my probably best years, because I had to work around knee operations all the time, so I have to think about when did I have my knee operation. It always took me a long time to rehabilitate and recuperate. We didn't have any of the knowledge we have today, that we have today. What I had would have been very easy to take care of today. Achondroplasia would have been easy peasy. But it was it got in the way, definitely. But what got in the way the most of not knowing how good I could be is the politics and trying to create a professional tennis. Chris Evert and I talk about this all the time. She's so sweet to me. She always goes, "Oh my gosh, you could have won so many more titles. People have no idea." You know, she's very nice to me about that. But you know, always having meetings, trying to go to sponsor meetings, getting sponsorship. I have two great feelings about the U.S. Open. First of all, I loved the fact we had open tennis in 68. I had fought for that. I got in trouble because of it. But we finally had all the best players playing at Forest Hills in the U.S. Open. So I was thrilled. And then we didn't get equal prize money. The women were making, I don't know, was it 30%, 35%? And we really wanted to have equal prize money. It's just important to have equality for all of us. And if it had been reversed, if the men had been at 30%, I would have been fighting for them like crazy, because that's just the right thing to do. And the great thing about tennis is you have a platform. And because of professional tennis, it was growing in interest. Television, all the best players could play together for the first time, like the Rod Labors of the world that had to skip 5 years in the 60s as a contract pro. Jack Kramer's tour probably helped us go to professional or open tennis because he took all the best guys away. They didn't really care about the women, so the top women were always competing at the tournaments like forever. But I just thought it was important to be professional, because I grew up in team sports, and to be a pro meant you were good, like really good. And as an amateur, it meant you weren't as good. So as a child growing up in basketball, football, baseball, all the team sports, I always thought, I want to be a pro. So finally I could actually say I'm a pro. Well, in fact, I had a little child come up to me and go, "Hey, lady, are you pro?" It was one of the greatest feelings in my life to say, "Yes, I am."
Absolutely. And you were able to really wear that label proudly in the early 70s there when you were playing.
Yeah, he was so sweet. Yeah, because we actually were getting paid under the table, and finally we had integrity in our sport. So Billy, 1968 was really important. So we had integrity in our sport because we played for prize money now, and everybody just went out and played, and we made money by performance, which was fantastic in those early years.
72, I mean, we talked about your peak, but I would say if you had to pinpoint it, that really was the year, even more than 71, when you played your finest tennis.
I think 72 is probably my best year. We were playing the Virginia Slims of San Francisco during the Australian 72, but I won all the other three.
Yes.
So maybe that year I could have won the a Grand Slam, but I'll never know because I didn't go, and I thought it was much more important to be playing the Virginia Slim Series Tour than it was to be going to majors. We were trying to do something very special. And even Chris later, Martina, all of us missed a lot of majors. We were really trying to make professional tennis happen. But we were all playing the Virginia Slims of San Francisco during the Australian.
Yeah,
so
that's
people have to understand that we thought that was more important than winning major titles. And they put so much emphasis on major titles. But for my generation, and the generations before me, especially for the men, especially just the men, really, that wasn't fair, because someone like Rod Laver missed 20 majors, and he had 11 majors without playing those 5 years, probably his best year. So yeah. I don't like it when they talk about Grand Slams, and this one has more. Like Chris and Martina definitely would have had more than 24 singles if they hadn't given up a lot.
No doubt about it. But Billie Jean, let's talk a little bit now about Yvonne Goolagong, because to me, that 1974 final at Forest Hills, and I've talked to you about this match before, and I know it. I think it meant a lot to you. It was some of the most spectacular shot making and some of the greatest audience reaction I've ever heard at a major final. The crowd was gasping during the points. They were really exhilarated by what they were witnessing, and you came from behind to win that match 7-5 in the third. Talk about that victory in the context of your career and how you managed to fend off Yvonne on a day when she was enormously inspired.
Well, Yvonne was another one after Chris got going, and then Martina showed, and Yvonne showed up. We knew we had really, I was really thrilled. We had some great superstars in our sport with those three. Yvonne was so natural, always the crowd's favorite because she's so balletic and smooth. But we were both quick, very quick. The courts had divots in it, and they'd actually put the divots back in the court, and they sprayed it with green spray paint, you know, out of a can.
Yes, yes.
And if we put our foot in on that, it would come. It, first of all, it'd come up, but it would get sticky on the bottom of our feet. So I can tell you, we had a lot going on that day. I almost did not play the U.S. Open that year because we just started World Team Tennis.
Right.
And I was the player coach for the Philadelphia Freedoms, and we played 3 months, and I was exhausted, and I thought, you know, I don't know if I need to play the Open. So I almost didn't enter. I entered at the last second.
What changed your mind?
I probably got a little rest for a moment, whatever the deadline was. And I thought, I don't want to have any regrets later that I didn't play in my own country's tournament. You know, the title of the U.S. Open, U.S., I'm an American. I'm very, you know, much for my country. I love playing Fed Cup, representing my country. I love it. I think I would rather do that than anything. So, you know, I like team situations anyway. But when you're an American, you want to play in your own country's championships. So I think that's probably why, because I don't want to have any regrets, and it's my country. And I think it was important that I do play, because I am an American, and I just played Riggs the year before. Oh my God, a lot happened. A lot was going on. When I think of that U.S. Open, I think that belongs to everyone. That's what it's about. It's like we're welcoming all of you. We want all of you to come out and love the tennis and be inspired by it and share in it, because we are in entertainment. And I think that's something that I don't know what the players feel, but they have to understand that we're entertainers. We're there for the people. The people aren't there for us. And I think sometimes we forget. So I think that's really important. And we owe it to give it everything we have and to share the experience with those people watching. And hopefully they'll be inspired to have a voice, to be the best they can be, whatever they do in their life.